Thank you. I was at a talk a few years ago given by the great Noam Chomsky. He came in with a sheath of papers about this thick and said, "A lot of people say I'm boring, and I'm proud to be boring." So this is thick, but we live in a dangerous moment. The decision by the deep state in ancient Rome, like the United States in 2017, dominated by a bloated military and a corrupt oligarchy, to strangle the Emperor Commodus in his bath in the year 192 did not halt the growing chaos and precipitous decline of the Roman Empire. Commodus, like a number of other late Roman emperors and like Donald Trump, was incompetent and consumed by his own vanity. He had commissioned innumerable statues of himself as Hercules and had little interest in governance. He used his position as head of state to make himself the star of his own ongoing public show. He fought victoriously as a gladiator in the arena in fixed bouts. Power for Commodus, like Trump, was primarily about catering to his bottomless narcissism, hedonism, and lust for wealth. He sold public offices so the ancient equivalents of Betsy DeVos and Steve Mnuchin could orchestrate a vast kleptocracy. Commodus was replaced by the reformer Pertinax, the Bernie Sanders of his day, who attempted to curb the unchecked power of the Praetorian Guards, the ancient version of the military-industrial complex. This effort saw the Praetorian Guards assassinate Pertinax after 3 months in office. The guards then auctioned off the office of emperor to the highest bidder. The next emperor, Didius Julianus, lasted 66 days. There would be 5 emperors in 193, the year after the assassination of Commodus. Trump and our decaying empire have ominous historical precedents. If the deep state replaces Trump, whose ineptitude and imbecility are embarrassing to the empire, that action will not restore our democracy any more than replacing Commodus restored the Republic in Rome. The choice will be between inept fascists like Trump and competent fascists like Pence. Our republic is dead. The idiots, seeing in the decay the chance for personal advancement and profit, take over in the final days of crumbling civilizations. Idiot generals wage endless, unwinnable wars that bankrupt the nation. Idiot economists call for reducing taxes for the rich and cutting social service programs for the poor and project economic growth on the basis of myth. Idiot industrialists poison the water, the soil, and the air, slash jobs, and depress wages. Idiot bankers gamble on self-created financial bubbles and impose crippling debt peonage on the citizens. Idiot journalists and public intellectuals pretend despotism is democracy. Idiot intelligence officers orchestrate the overthrow of foreign governments to create lawless enclaves that give rise to enraged fanatics. Idiot professors, experts, and specialists busy themselves with unintelligible jargon and arcane theory that buttress the politics of the rulers, and idiot entertainers and producers create lurid spectacles of sex, gore, and fantasy. There is a familiar checklist for extinction. We are ticking off every item on it. The idiots know only one word, more. They are unencumbered by common sense. They hoard wealth and resources until workers cannot make a living and the infrastructure collapses. They live in privileged compounds where they eat chocolate cake and order missile strikes. They see the state as a projection of their own vanity. The Roman, Mayan, French, Habsburg, Ottoman, Romanov, Wilhelmine, Pahlavi, and Soviet dynasties crumbled because the whims and obsessions of ruling idiots were law. And Donald Trump is the face of our collective idiocy. He is what lies behind the mask of our professed civility and rationality, a sputtering, narcissistic, bloodthirsty megalomaniac. This face, in the past, was hidden, at least to white Americans, but with the destruction of democratic institutions and the disempowerment of the citizen, the oligarchs and the kleptocrats have become brazen. They no longer need to hide the pillage. They can steal and lie in the open. They can wield armies and fleets against the wretched of the earth, blithely ignore the looming catastrophe caused by global warming, and cannibalize the nation on behalf of global oligarchs, while at night, like some monster from the Grand Guignol, the idiot in chief, overseeing our self-immolation, sits slack-jawed in front of a television set before opening his beautiful Twitter account. Forget the firing of James Comey. Forget the paralysis in Congress. Forget the inanity of a press that covers our descent into tyranny as if it were a sports contest between corporate Republicans and corporate Democrats, or a reality show starring our maniacal president and the freaks that surround him. Forget the noise. The crisis we face is not embodied in the public images of the politicians that run our dysfunctional state. The crisis we face is the result of a four-decade-long, slow-motion corporate coup d'etat that has rendered the citizen impotent, left us without any authentic democratic institutions, and allowed corporate and military power to become omnipotent. The crisis has spawned a corrupt electoral system of legalized bribery and elevated public figures that master the arts of entertainment and artifice. Trump is the symptom. He is not the disease. Our descent into despotism began with the pardoning of Richard Nixon, all of whose impeachable crimes are now legal, and the extrajudicial assault, including targeted assassinations and imprisonment carried out on dissidents and radicals, especially black radicals. It began with the creation of corporate-funded foundations and organizations that took control of the press, the courts, the universities, scientific research, and the two major political parties. It began with empowering militarized police to kill unarmed citizens and the spread of our horrendous system of mass incarceration and the death penalty. It began with a stripping away of our most basic constitutional rights, privacy, due process, habeas corpus, fair elections, and dissent. It began when big money was employed by political operatives such as Roger Stone, a close Trump advisor, to create negative political advertisements and spread malicious gossip and false narratives, all eagerly amplified by a media devoted to profits and ratings, not truth, to deceive the public until political debate became burlesque. It began in the 1960s and 70s with a war on dissidents and radicals, especially black radicals, which included FBI assassinations of leaders such as Fred Hampton. This war against radicals, President Nixon's so-called battle for law and order, put the police, the FBI, and other organs of internal security beyond the reach of the law. And this power has steadily expanded. We are all under state surveillance, and we can all become victims if the state deems us to be a threat. The ruling elites, terrified by the mobilization of the left in the 1960s, or by what the political scientist Samuel Huntington called America's excess of democracy, built counter-institutions to delegitimize and marginalize critics of corporate capitalism and imperialism. They bought the allegiances of the two main political parties. They imposed obedience to the neoliberal ideology within academia and the press. This campaign, laid out by Lewis Powell in his 1971 memorandum titled Attack on American Free Enterprise System, was the blueprint for the creeping coup that 45 years later is complete. And our failure to defend the rights of those who were demonized and persecuted leaves us all demonized and persecuted. Our failure to demand justice for everyone leaves us all without justice. Our failure to halt the crushing of popular movements that stand unequivocally with the oppressed leaves us all oppressed. Our failure to protect our democracy leaves us without a democracy. The persecution of the radicals of four decades ago is not ancient history. It is the genesis of the present. It spawned the corporate coup and the machinery of state terror. We will pay for our complacency. We are trapped like rats in a cage. A narcissist, an imbecile, may be turning the electric shocks on and off. But the problem is the corporate state. And unless we dismantle the corporate state, we are doomed. Racist, violent, and despotic forces have always been part of the American landscape and have often been tolerated and empowered by the state to persecute poor people of color and dissidents. These forces are denied absolute power as long as a majority of citizens, white citizens, have a say in their own governance. But once citizens are locked out of government and denied a voice, power shifts into the hands of the enemies of the open society. When democratic institutions cease to function, when the consent of the governed becomes a joke, despots fill the political void. They give vent to popular anger and frustration while arming the state to do to the majority what it has long done to the minority. This tale is as old as civilization. It was played out in ancient Greece and Rome, the Soviet Union, fascist Germany, fascist Italy, and the former Yugoslavia. Once a tiny cabal seizes power, monarchist, communist, fascist, or corporate, it creates a mafia economy and a mafia state. Trump and his coterie of billionaires, generals, half-wits, Christian fascists, criminals, racists, and deviants play the role of the Snopes clan in some of William Faulkner's novels. The Snopeses filled the power vacuum of the decayed South and ruthlessly seized control from the degenerated former slaveholding aristocratic elites. Flem Snopes and his extended family, which includes a killer, a pedophile, a bigamist, an arsonist, a mentally disabled man who copulates with a cow, and a relative who sells tickets to witness the bestiality, are fictional representations of the moral rot unleashed by unfettered capitalism. The usual reference to amorality, while accurate, is not sufficiently distinctive and by itself does not allow us to place them as they should be placed in a historical moment, the critic Irving Howe wrote of the Snopeses. Perhaps the most important thing to be said is that they are what comes afterwards, the creatures that emerge from the devastation with the slime still upon their lips. Let a world collapse in the South or Russia, and there appear figures of coarse ambition, driving their way up from beneath the social bottom, men to whom moral claims are not so much absurd as incomprehensible, sons of bushwhackers and musics drifting in from nowhere and taking over through the sheer outrageousness of their monolithic force, Howe wrote. They become presidents of local banks and chairmen of party regional committees, and later, a trifle slicked up, they muscle their way into Congress or the Politburo. Scavengers without inhibition. They need not believe in the crumbling official code of their society. They need only learn to mimic its sounds. Societies that were once open and had democratic traditions are easy prey for the enemies of democracy. Demagogues pay deference to the political ideals, rituals, practices, and forms of the old democratic political system while dismantling it. When the Roman Emperor Augustus, he referred to himself as the first citizen, neutered the Republic, he was careful to maintain the form of the old Republic. Lenin and the Bolsheviks did the same when they seized and crushed the autonomous Soviets. Even the Nazis and Stalinists insisted they rule democratic states. Despotic government, as Thomas Paine wrote, is a fungus that grows out of a corrupt civil society. This is what happened to these older democracies. It is what happened to us. Corporations cannibalizing the federal budget are legally empowered to exploit and loot. It is impossible to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs or ExxonMobil. The pharmaceutical and insurance industries are legally empowered to hold sick children hostage while their parents frantically bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. Banks are legally empowered to burden people with student loans that cannot be forgiven even by declaring bankruptcy. The animal agriculture industry is legally empowered in many states to charge those who attempt to publicize the conditions in the vast factory farms where diseased animals are warehoused for slaughter with a criminal offense. Corporations are legally empowered to carry out tax boycotts. Free trade deals legally empower global companies to destroy small farmers and businesses and deindustrialize the country. Government agencies designed to protect the public from contaminated air, water, and food, and from usurious creditors and lenders have been defanged. The Supreme Court, in an inversion of rights worthy of George Orwell, defines unlimited corporate contributions to electoral campaigns as a right to petition the government and a form of free speech. The press, owned by corporations, is an echo chamber for the elites. State and city enterprises and utilities are sold to corporations that hike rates and deny services. The educational system is being slowly privatized and turned into a species of vocational training. Wages are stagnant or have declined. Unemployment and underemployment, masked by falsified statistics, have thrust half the country into chronic poverty. Social services are abolished in the name of austerity. Culture and arts have been replaced by sexual commodification and graphic depictions of violence. The infrastructure, neglected and underfunded, is collapsing. Bankruptcies, foreclosures, food shortages, and untreated illnesses that lead to early death plague a harried underclass. The desperate flee into an underground economy dominated by drugs, crime, and human trafficking, and the state, rather than address the economic misery, militarizes police departments and empowers them to use lethal force against unarmed civilians. It fills the prisons with 2.3 million citizens, only a tiny percentage of whom, less than 6%, have a trial. 1 million prisoners now work for corporations inside of prisons as modern-day slaves, paid pennies on the dollar and without any rights or protection. They are the corporate state's version of the model worker. The amendments of the Constitution designed to protect the citizen from tyranny are meaningless. The Fourth Amendment, for example, reads, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. Supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." The reality is that our telephone calls, emails, texts, financial, judicial, and medical records, along with every website we visit, and our physical travels are tracked, recorded, and stored in perpetuity in government computer banks. The state tortures, not only in black sites, such as the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan or Guantanamo Bay, but in Supermax ADX facilities, such as the one in Florence, Colorado, where prisoners suffer psychological breakdowns from prolonged solitary confinement, where prisoners, although they are citizens, endure around-the-clock electronic monitoring and 23-hour-a-day lockdowns, where they undergo extreme sensory deprivation and endure beatings, where they must shower and go to the bathroom on camera, where they can write only one letter a week to one relative and cannot use more than three pieces of paper, where they have no access to fresh air and take their 1 hour of daily recreation in a huge cage that resembles a treadmill for hamsters. The state uses special administrative measures known as SAMs to strip citizens of their judicial rights. SAMs restrict a citizen's communication with the outside world. They end calls, letters, and visits with anyone except attorneys and sharply limit contact with family members. Citizens under SAMs are not permitted to see most of the evidence against them because of a legal provision called the Classified Information Procedures Act, or SIPA. SIPA, begun under the Reagan administration, allows evidence in a trial to be classified and withheld from those being prosecuted. These citizens are tried and convicted, like Joseph K. in Franz Kafka's The Trial, without ever seeing the evidence used to find them guilty. And under SAMs, it is against the law for those who have contact with someone under a SAM order, including attorneys, to speak about the physical and psychological conditions being inflicted on the prisoner. When prisoners are released, they have lost the right to vote and receive public assistance. They are burdened with fines that, if unpaid, will put them back behind bars. They are subject to arbitrary searches and arrests. They spend the rest of their lives marginalized as members of a vast criminal caste system. And that is why 76% of those released from state penitentiaries return to prison within 5 years. But our system of mass incarceration is not broken. It works exactly the way it is designed to work. The bodies of poor people of color do not generate money for corporations on the streets of our deindustrialized cities, but they generate $40,000 or $50,000 a year if they are locked in cages, and that is why they are there. The executive branch of government has empowered itself to assassinate U.S. citizens. It can call the army into the streets to quell civil unrest under Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, overturning the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibited the military from acting as a domestic police force. The executive branch can order the military to seize U.S. citizens deemed to be terrorists or associated with terrorists, and this is called extraordinary rendition. Those taken into custody by the military can be denied due process and habeas corpus and held indefinitely in military facilities. Activists and dissidents whose rights were once protected under the First Amendment can be threatened under this law with indefinite incarceration. Constitutionally protected statements, beliefs, and associations are criminalized. The state can detain and prosecute people not for what they have done, or even for what they are planning to do, but for holding religious or political beliefs that the state deems seditious. The first of those targeted have been observant Muslims, but they will not be the last. The outward forms of democratic participation, voting, competing political parties, judicial oversight, and legislation are meaningless theater. No one who lives under constant surveillance, who is subject to detention anywhere, at any time, who has lost their legal rights, who has no recourse to blunt corporate exploitation, whose conversations, messages, meetings, proclivities, and habits are recorded, stored, and analyzed, can be described as free. The relationship between the state and the citizen who is watched constantly is one of master and slave, and the shackles will not be removed if Trump disappears. The dismantling of democratic institutions, places where the citizen had agency and a voice, is far graver than the ascendancy to the White House of Trump. The coup destroyed the two-party system. It destroyed labor unions. It destroyed public education. It destroyed the judiciary. It destroyed the press. It destroyed academia. It destroyed consumer and environmental protection. It destroyed our industrial base, and it destroyed our communities and our cities. It destroyed the lives of tens of millions of Americans, no longer able to find work that provides a living wage, cursed to live in chronic poverty or locked in cages. Perhaps even more ominously, this coup destroyed the credibility of liberal democracy itself. Self-identified liberals, such as the Clintons or Barack Obama, mouthed the words of liberal democratic values while making war on these values in the service of corporate power. The revolt we see rippling across the country is a revolt not only against a corporate system that has betrayed workers, but also for many, liberal democracy. And this is very dangerous. it will allow the radical right, with or without Trump, to cement into place an Americanized fascism. The acceleration of deindustrialization by the 1970s created a crisis that forced the ruling elites to adopt a new ideology, which Stuart Hall examines in his book, Policing the Crisis. This ideology, trumpeted by a compliant media, shifted its focus from the common good to race, crime, and so-called law and order. It told those undergoing profound economic and political change that their suffering stemmed not from corporate greed, but from a threat to national integrity. The old consensus that buttressed the programs of the New Deal and the welfare state was discredited as enabling criminal black youth, welfare queens, and social parasites. These parasites were to blame. And this opened the door to an authoritarian populism begun by Reagan and Thatcher, which supposedly championed family values, traditional morality, individual autonomy, law and order, the Christian faith, and the return of a mythical past. It turns out, 45 years later, that those who truly hate us for our freedoms are not the array of dehumanized enemies cooked up by the war machine, the Vietnamese, the Cambodians, Afghans, Iraqis, Iranians, even the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or ISIS. They are the financiers, bankers, politicians, public intellectuals and pundits, journalists and business people, cultivated in the elite universities and business schools, who sold us the utopian dream of neoliberalism. We are entering the twilight phase of capitalism, which, as Karl Marx understood, would see capitalists unable to generate past profits by expanding markets. And they would, he predicted, begin to cannibalize the state like ravenous parasites. Wealth is no longer created by producing or manufacturing. It is created by manipulating the prices of stocks and commodities and imposing a crippling debt peonage on the public. Our casino capitalism has merged with the gambling industry, and it is designed to prey on the desperate young men and women burdened by student loans, underpaid workers burdened by credit card debt and mortgages, towns and cities forced to borrow to maintain municipal services. This moment in human history marks the end of a long, sad tale of greed and murder by the white race. It is inevitable that for the final show, we vomited up someone as grotesque as Trump. Europeans and Americans have spent five centuries conquering, plundering, exploiting, and polluting the earth in the name of human progress. They used the technological superiority to create the most efficient killing machine on the planet, and they directed it against anyone or anything, especially indigenous cultures, which stood in their way. They stole and hoarded the planet's wealth and resources. They believed that this orgy of blood and gold would never end, and they still believe it. They do not understand that the dark ethic of ceaseless capitalist and imperialist expansion is ultimately dooming the exploiters as well as the exploited. But even as we stand on the cusp of extinction, we lack the intelligence and imagination to break free from the myth of human progress. Walter Benjamin wrote in 1940 amid the rise of European fascism and looming world war. A Klee painting named Angelus Novus shows an angel looking as though he is about to move away from something he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring, his mouth is open, his wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned towards the past. Where we perceive a chain of events, he sees one single catastrophe, which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and hurls it in front of his feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed. But a storm is blowing from paradise. It has got caught in his wings with such violence that the angel can no longer close them. The storm irresistibly propels him into the future, to which his back is turned, while the pile of debris before him grows skyward. The storm is what we call progress. The more the warning signs are palpable, rising temperatures, global financial meltdowns, mass human migrations, endless wars, poisoned ecosystems, rampant corruption among the ruling class. The more we turn to those who chant, either through idiocy or cynicism, the mantra that what worked in the past will work in the future, that progress is inevitable. Factual evidence, since it is an impediment to what we desire, is banished. The taxes of corporations and the rich, who have turned much of our cities into wastelands, are cut, and regulations are slashed to bring back the supposed golden era of the 1950s, at least for white Americans. Public lands are opened up to the oil and gas industry as rising carbon emissions doom our species. Declining crop yields stemming from heat waves and droughts are ignored. War and the huge profits war generates for corporations becomes the principal business of the kleptocratic state. Magical thinking is not limited to the beliefs and practices of pre-modern cultures. It defines the ideology of capitalism. Quotas and projected sales can always be met. Profits can always be raised. Growth is inevitable. The impossible is always possible. Human societies, if they bow before the dictates of the marketplace, will be ushered into a capitalist paradise. It is only a question of having the right attitude and the right technique. When capitalism thrives, we are assured we thrive. The merging of the self with the capitalist collective has robbed us of our agency, creativity, capacity for self-reflection, and moral autonomy. We define our worth not by our independence or our character, but by the material standards set by capitalism: personal wealth, brand, status, career advancement. We are molded into a compliant and repressed collective. This mass conformity is characteristic of totalitarian and authoritarian states. It is characterized by the Disneyfication of America, the land of eternally happy thoughts and positive attitudes. And when magical thinking does not work, we are told and often accept that we are the problem. We must have more faith. We must envision what we want. We must try harder. The system is never to blame. We failed it. It does not fail us. And all of our systems of information, from self-help gurus in Hollywood to political monstrosities such as Trump, sell us this snake oil. What now does resistance look like? It will not come by investing hope in the Democratic Party, which... which has steadily lost power, not because of Comey or the Russians, but because it betrayed working men and women on behalf of corporate power. Because it used its machinery to deny the one candidate, Bernie Sanders, who could have defeated Trump, from getting the nomination. The proposed cuts, $9.2 billion from the Department of Education, $616 billion from Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program over 10 years, $200 billion from the food stamp program, a lifeline for 44 million people, $72 billion for people with disabilities, $39 billion for subsidized student loans, and $859 million for public service loan forgiveness, along with a $500 billion increase to the Pentagon's budget over the next decade. Accelerate austerity programs and militarism that have also been embraced by the Democratic Party. As Diane Ravitch has pointed out, Betsy DeVos is a monster the Democrats helped create. DeVos's proposed voucher system, allowing parents to use public funds for private and religious schools, is modeled on a school choice system introduced by Governor Bill Clinton and embraced by Obama and Arne Duncan. Obama closed countless public schools and doubled the number of students attending charter schools. What is happening now is simply the final deluge. Resistance will come with a personal commitment not to cooperate in large and small ways to impede the machinery of corporate power, especially the fossil fuel industry. After all, the only safe figure of carbon emissions is zero. This will require us, as Ralph Nader has long said, to show up. We have to, as Max Weber advised, make politics a vocation. In the conflicts I covered as a reporter in Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and the Balkans, I encountered singular individuals of varying creeds, religions, races, and nationalities who majestically rose up to defy the oppressor on behalf of the oppressed. Some of them are dead. Many of them are forgotten. These individuals, despite their vast cultural differences, had common traits: a profound commitment to the truth, incorruptibility, courage, a distrust of power, a hatred of violence, and a deep empathy that was extended to people who were different from them, even to people defined by the dominant culture as the enemy. They are the most remarkable men and women I met in my 20 years as a foreign correspondent. And to this day, I set my life by the standards they set. You have heard of some of them, such as Václav Havel, whom I and other foreign reporters met most evenings during the 1989 Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, in the Magic Lantern Theater in Prague. Others no less great you probably do not know, such as the Jesuit priest Ignacio Ellacuría, who was assassinated in El Salvador in 1989. And then there are those ordinary people, although as the writer V.S. Pritchett said, no people are ordinary, who risk their lives in wartime to shelter and protect those of an opposing religion or ethnicity from being persecuted and hunted. And to some of these ordinary people, I owe my life. To resist radical evil, to endure a life, is to endure a life that by the standards of the wider society is a failure. It is to defy injustice at the cost of your career, your reputation, your financial solvency, and at times your life. It is to be a lifelong heretic. And perhaps this is the most important point. It is to accept that the dominant culture, even and maybe especially the liberal elites, will push you to the margins and attempt to discredit not only what you do, but your character. When I returned to the newsroom at the New York Times in 2003 for denouncing the invasion of Iraq and being publicly reprimanded by the paper for my stance against the war, reporters and editors I had known and worked with for 15 years lowered their heads or turned away when I was nearby. They did not want to be contaminated with the same career-killing disease. Ruling institutions, the state, the press, the church, courts, academia, mouth the language of morality, but they serve the structures of power, no matter how venal, which provide them with money, status, and authority. In times of national distress, and one has only to look at Nazi Germany, all of these institutions, including the academy, are complicit through their silence or their active collaboration with radical evil. And our institutions are no different. The lonely individuals who defy tyrannical power within these institutions, as we saw with the thousands of academics who were fired from their jobs and blacklisted during the McCarthy era, are usually purged and turned into pariahs. All institutions, including the church, Paul Tillich once wrote, are inherently demonic. And a life dedicated to resistance has to accept that a relationship with any institution is usually temporary. Because sooner or later, that institution is going to demand acts of silence or obedience your conscience will not allow you to make. To be a rebel is to reject what it means to succeed in a capitalist consumer culture. The idea that we and not our neighbor come first. The theologian James Cone, the greatest theologian in America, in his book The Cross and the Lynching Tree, writes that for oppressed blacks, the cross was a paradoxical religious symbol because it inverts the world's value system. With the news that hope comes by way of defeat, that suffering and death do not have the last word, that the last shall be first and the first last. Cone continues, that God could make a way out of no way in Jesus' cross was truly absurd to the intellect, yet profoundly real in the souls of black folk. Enslaved blacks who first heard the gospel message seized on the power of the cross. Christ crucified manifested God's loving and liberating presence in the contradictions of black life. That transcendent presence in the lives of black Christians that empowered them to believe that ultimately, in God's eschatological future, they would not be defeated by the troubles of this world, no matter how great and painful their suffering. Believing this paradox, this absurd claim of faith was only possible in humility and repentance. There was no place for the proud and the mighty, for people who think that God called them to rule over others. The cross was God's critique of power, white power, with powerless love, snatching victory out of defeat. Reinhold Niebuhr labeled this capacity to defy the forces of repression a sublime madness in the soul. Niebuhr wrote that nothing but madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places. This sublime madness, as Niebuhr understood, is dangerous, but it is vital. Without it, truth is obscured. And Niebuhr also knew that traditional liberalism was a useless force in moments of extremity. Liberalism, Niebuhr said, lacks the spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. It is too intellectual and too little emotional to be an efficient force in history. The prophets in the Hebrew Bible had this sublime madness. The words of the Hebrew prophets, as Abraham Heschel wrote, were a scream in the night. While the world is at ease and asleep, the prophet feels the blast from heaven. The prophet, because he or she saw and faced an unpleasant reality, was compelled to proclaim the very opposite of what his or her heart expected. This sublime madness is the essential quality for a life of resistance. It is the acceptance that when you stand with the oppressed, you get treated like the oppressed. It is the acceptance that though empirically all that we struggle to achieve during our lifetime may be worse, our struggle validates itself. Daniel Berrigan told me that faith is the belief that the good draws to it the good. The Buddhists call this karma. But he said for us, we did not know where it went. We trusted that it went somewhere, but we did not know where. We are called to do the good, or at least the good so far as we can determine it, and then let it go. As Hannah Arendt wrote in The Origins of Totalitarianism, the only morally reliable people are not those who say this is wrong or this should not be done, but those who say, I can't. They know that, as Immanuel Kant wrote, if justice perishes, human life on earth has lost its meaning. And this means that, like Socrates, we must come to a place where it is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. We must at once see and act, and given what it means to see, this will require the surmounting of despair, not by reason, but by faith. I saw in the conflicts I covered this power of faith, which lies outside of any religious or philosophical creed. This faith is what Havel called in his great essay, The Power of the Powerless, living in truth. Living in truth exposes the corruption, lies, and deceit of the state. It is a refusal to be part of the charade, and it has a cost. You do not become a dissident just because you decide one day to take up this most unusual career, Havel wrote. You are thrown into it by your personal sense of responsibility, combined with a complex set of external circumstances. You are cast out of the existing structures and placed in a position of conflict with them. It begins as an attempt to do your work well and ends with being branded an enemy of society. The dissident does not operate in the realm of genuine power at all. He or she is not seeking power. He or she has no desire for office and does not gather votes. He or she does not attempt to charm the public. He or she offers nothing and promises nothing. He or she can offer, if anything, only their own skin, and they offer it solely because they have no other way of affirming the truth they stand for. Their actions simply articulate their dignity as a citizen, regardless of the cost. The long, long road of sacrifice and suffering that led to the collapse of the communist regimes stretched back decades. Those who made change possible were those who had discarded all notions of the practical. They did not try to reform the Communist Party. They did not attempt to work within the system. They did not even know what, if anything, their tiny protests, ignored by the state-controlled media, would accomplish. But through it all, they held fast to moral imperatives. They did so because these values were right and just. They expected no reward for their virtue. Indeed, they got none. They were marginalized and persecuted. And yet, these rebels, poets, playwrights, actors, singers, writers, ultimately triumphed over state and military power. They drew the good to the good. They triumphed because, however cowed and broken the masses around them appeared, their message of defiance did not go unheard. It did not go unseen. The steady drumbeat of rebellion constantly exposed the dead hand of authority and the rot of the state. I stood with hundreds of thousands of rebellious Czechs in 1989 on a cold winter night in Prague's Venceslav Square, as the singer Marta Kubišová approached the balcony of the Milantrik building. Kubišová had been banished from the airwaves in 1989 after the Soviet invasion for her anthem of defiance, Prayer for Marta. Her entire catalog, including more than 200 singles, had been confiscated and destroyed by the state. She had disappeared from public view. Her voice that night suddenly flooded the square. Pressing around me were throngs of students, most of whom had not been born when she vanished. They began to sing the words of the anthem. There were tears running down their faces. It was then that I understood the power of resistance. It was then that I knew that no act of rebellion, however futile it appears in the moment, is wasted. And it was then that I knew that the communist regime was finished. The walls of Prague were covered that chilly winter with posters depicting Jan Palach. Palach, a university student, set himself on fire in Venceslav Square on January 16, 1969, in the middle of the day, to protest the crushing of the country's democracy movement. He died of his burns 3 days later. The state swiftly attempted to erase his act from national memory. There was no mention of it on the state media. A funeral march by university students was broken up by police. Pollock's gravesite, which became a shrine, saw the communist authorities exhume his body, cremate his remains, and ship them to his mother, with the provision that his ashes could not be placed in a cemetery. But it did not work. His defiance remained a rallying cry. His sacrifice spurred the students in the winter of 1989 to act. Prague's Red Army Square, shortly after I left for Bucharest to cover the uprising in Romania, was renamed Pollock Square, and 10,000 people went to the dedication. We, like those who oppose the long night of communism, no longer have any mechanisms within the formal structures of power that will protect or advance our rights. We too have undergone a coup carried out not by stone-faced leaders of a monolithic corporate party, but the heads of corporations. We may feel in the face of the ruthless corporate destruction of our nation, our culture, our ecosystem, powerless and weak, but we are not. We have a power that terrifies the corporate state. Any act of rebellion, no matter how few people show up or how heavily it is censored, chips away at corporate power. Any act of rebellion keeps alive the embers for larger movements that follow us. It passes on another narrative. It will, as the state consumes itself, attract wider and wider numbers. Perhaps this will not happen in our lifetimes, but if we persist, we keep this possibility alive. And if we do not, it will die. Dr. Rio and Albert Camus' novel, The Plague, is not driven by ideology. He is driven by empathy, the duty to minister to suffering, no matter the cost. Empathy, or what the Russian novelist Vasily Grossman called simple human kindness, becomes in all despotisms a subversive act. To act on this empathy, the empathy for human beings locked in cages, the empathy for undocumented mothers and fathers torn from their children on the streets of our cities, the empathy for Muslims who are demonized and banned from our shores, fleeing the wars and terror we created, the empathy for poor people of color gunned down by police in our streets, the empathy for girls and women trafficked into prostitution, the empathy for all those who suffer at the hands of a state intent on militarization and imposing a harsh cruelty on the vulnerable. An empathy for this great and glorious earth that gives us life and that is being contaminated for profit. This empathy becomes political and dangerous. Evil is real. So is love. And in war, especially when the heavy shells landed on crowds in Sarajevo, sights so gruesome that to this day I cannot eat a piece of meat, you could feel as frantic family members desperately sought out loved ones among the wounded and dead, the concentric circles of death and love, death and love, like rings from the blast of a cosmic furnace. A life of faith, and we are all called to faith, is a life of confrontation. As Flannery O'Connor writes of St. Cyril of Jerusalem, an instructing catechumens, the dragon sits by the side of the road, watching those who pass. Beware, lest he devour you. We go to the Father of souls, but it is necessary to pass by the dragon. No matter what form the dragon may take, it is this mysterious passage past him or into his jaws that stories of any depth will always be concerned to tell. And this being the case, it requires considerable courage at any time in any country not to turn away from the storyteller. Accept sorrow, for who cannot be profoundly sorrowful at the state of our nation, the world, and what we are doing to our planet? But know that in resistance, there is a balm that leads to wisdom, and if not joy, a strange, transcendent happiness. My faith has been tempered in hell, wrote Grossman. My faith has emerged from the flames of the crematoria, from the concrete of the gas chamber. I have seen that it is not man who is impotent in the struggle against evil, but the power of evil that is impotent in the struggle against man. The powerlessness of kindness, of senseless kindness, is the secret of its immortality. It can never be conquered. The more stupid, the more senseless, the more helpless it may seem, the vaster it is. Evil is impotent before it. The prophets, religious leaders, reformers, social and political leaders are impotent before it. This dumb, blind love is man's meaning. Human history is not the battle of good struggling to overcome evil. It is a battle fought by a great evil, struggling to crush a small kernel of human kindness. But if what is human in human beings has not been destroyed even now, then evil will never conquer. The days ahead will be dark and frightening. We fight for the sacred. We fight for life. We fight the forces of death. We fight not only for ourselves, but for those who will come after us, our children. Revolt is a political necessity. It is a moral imperative, and we must not be complicit in this self-annihilation. We must live in truth. The moment we defy power in any form, we are victorious. The moment we stand alongside the oppressed, we are victorious. The moment we hold up a flickering light in the darkness for others to see, we are victorious. The moment we thwart the building of a pipeline or a fracking site, we are victorious. The moment we keep a mother faced with deportation with her children, we are victorious. We must turn the tide of fear. We must, by taking to the streets, make them frightened of us. To sit idle, to refuse to defy these forces, to by our silence be complicit, will atrophy and wither our souls. It will leave us as husks of human beings. This is not only a fight for life, it is a fight that gives life. It is the supreme expression of faith. It is the belief that no matter how great is the power of evil, the power of love is greater. And in the end, I do not fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you.
Again, let's have a big thank you for Chris Hedges. You got through that thickness pretty well. The theme of tonight was overcoming fascism. And with different sectors and layers of this society feeling the effects of fascism in different ways, what are some, or do you see some immediate and practical steps that we can take that are effective and beneficial for all of us?
I think it really comes down to walking out into the street and carrying out acts of civil disobedience and sustained mass protests. There, as you correctly point out, are a myriad of issues. There are innumerable fronts on which we have to fight. These movements, I think, have a common enemy, but that enemy is diffuse. Whether you're fighting the fossil fuel industry, whether you're fighting the animal agriculture industry, whether you're fighting the war machine, in the end, you're fighting, of course, the hegemony of corporate power. But there are so many battlefronts. And of course, I think so much has to be done locally. I think that we have to rebuild resistance, and it's going to be rebuilt within our communities around issues within the community that are carrying out assaults against the common good, and that's every community in this country.
So do you see that rebuilding being different depending on what communities you're in, what communities you're from?
Yeah. I mean, if you live in a community, different communities have different issues.
Right.
I mean, some communities are not affected by fracking and some communities are. But I think it's safe to say that there's no community at this point that's immune from the corporate onslaught.
One of the solutions you gave a little while ago was to dismantle this system. How do you propose to build a political movement to dismantle the corporate state as it is
well,
now?
Well, I watched, you know, I covered the fall of East Germany, so I watched it happen. And those movements have a kind of mysterious force that no one can predict. They're often triggered by something relatively banal. I mean, for instance, the first Intifada by the Palestinians was triggered ostensibly by an Israeli truck crashing into a van filled with Palestinian day workers and killing seven of them. But it was just, it was the tipping point. It was the breaking point. People had had enough. And I watched that happen. I mean, the Stasi state in East Germany was the most efficient security and surveillance state until our own. And that's why, I mean, I've covered occupations such as Gaza. I've covered civil wars such as Salvador. But revolutions are inherently nonviolent because they only succeed when at least a significant portion of the civil bureaucracy and the organs of internal security will no longer protect a discredited regime. And that's what happened in East Germany, where the communist dictator Erich Honecker sent down an elite paratroop division to Leipzig, which was the epicenter of the protests, and they refused to fire on the crowd. It was over. That also was true in Czechoslovakia. It was true in the Russian Revolution when the Cossacks were sent to quell a bread riot in Petrograd and didn't, and fraternized with the crowd. And I think that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about revolution. I'm talking about overthrow. I'll spell that for the members of Homeland Security in the audience. That's O.
Right now we look and we see Donald Trump as the face of fascism in this country. And although he's just the latest chapter, how do you see him and his surrounding cast? Do you see them as being any more dangerous than what we faced in the past?
Well, I think Trump is the product of a decayed system. And in a sense, he's more dangerous because the system is so emboldened that it no longer has to hide behind the pretense of democracy or civility. So on the one hand, he's more dangerous. On the other hand, he's the inevitable result of the system. And I think that we're fooling ourselves by thinking that removing Trump is somehow going to remove the problem.
What do you think about the current resistant movements that are going on now? Can they survive and be successful without a political party?
Well, I worked very closely with Ralph Nader, and so I'm keenly aware of all of the ways that the Republicans and the Democrats make it impossible to mount a third-party challenge. I think that probably our hope for the turning of power will happen locally first. And in a way, that's kind of how these organic movements work. And I think we have to begin to take back our cities and our towns. And we have to put people in those cities and towns who are fierce anti-capitalists.
In that regard, corporations are now being protected as personhood.
You know,
companies are being protected as if they're people. How do we combat that?
Well, our moral imperative is just destroy those corporations. We have to destroy them. We have to impose such punitive taxes on the fossil fuel industry that it's not profitable to destroy our planet. But that isn't going to come by anyone in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the kinds of things that we have to begin to do, which we saw in Spain, 10,000 people surrounded the Spanish parliament. That's the kind of stuff we have to do. Nobody knows better how corrupt this system is than the people who run it. No one. And they're just scared of being found out. But that's the kind of activity that we have to begin to organize.
There was an uproar over at UC Berkeley about Ann Coulter being scheduled to speak there. In your opinion, does the difficulty of scheduling an appearance by Ann Coulter on the campus constitute as a serious abridgment of free speech?
Well, Karl Popper in the Open Society and Its Enemies had a great line saying, you know, in any society of unlimited tolerance, then finally, tolerance is abolished and the tolerant along with them. I think that figures like Ann Coulter can justifiably be considered purveyors of racist hate speech. And the fault lies with the university, which should have never invited her. And this is part of the... There are things in a civil society you shouldn't tolerate.
Right.
And when I was at Harvard Divinity School, one of my professors invited Jerry Falwell to come give a talk. They're all into dialogue, you know. So we organized, we got the dean of every school, including the Divinity School, to denounce it. I think we created enough pressure that he and other figures like him were not going to come back. But I think that the focus of the anger should be at the university administration.
Mm-hmm.
Because figures like that, I mean, we can just take alone what she says about Muslims. I mean, but we have people like Bill Maher saying this stuff on... I mean, this stuff is just not acceptable in a civil society.
And Bill Maher is actually considered someone who's a liberal.
No, he's a racist.
Yes.
Many liberals are racists.
Do you believe slain DNC Seth Rich last summer may have been a source of leaked emails to WikiLeaks? And do you support the legal case supported by attorney Jared Beck and his wife against the DNC for unfair practices in the primary against Bernie's followers?
On the first, as a former reporter, I can't answer that question because I didn't report it. Mm-hmm. I don't know any. I don't know it. On the second, yes, because it was unfair practices. They, for instance, I mean, they stole the Nevada caucus. They used all sorts of corporate dark money. I mean, if people had to function off of contributions, Hillary Clinton would have never been able to mount a campaign. They banned independents from voting in the primaries, although, of course, the primaries are paid for by taxpayer dollars. I think it's abundantly clear that in a fair process, Sanders would have won. So, yeah, I do.
The Sanders campaign brought a movement to the streets to criticize Clinton. Sanders stood for some important issues, such as single payer, free university, etc. Please explain your thoughts on the Sanders campaign.
Well, I didn't support or endorse Sanders. I voted for him in the primary, but I wouldn't publicly support him. And I had a Shama Sawant, the socialist city councilwoman in Seattle, and I had a conversation with Bernie before he announced. And our position was, we will not support you if you run as a Democrat, because the Democrats have done as much damage as the Republicans. And you've got to call them out for who they are. You can't keep harping on the Koch brothers.
Right.
Goldman Sachs is just as vicious and criminal an enterprise, and they bankroll the Democratic Party. So that's number one. Number two, as happened, my fear was that he would build momentum, gather money, and then when he's denied the nomination, it would all go up in smoke as he told people to vote for Clinton, and damaging not only his own credibility but dispiriting many people who supported him. And I, the day that Bernie in Philadelphia endorsed Clinton at the Democratic National Convention, Cornel West and I, and among others, led a Poor People's March on the convention center. And I rode back to Princeton in the car with Cornell, and we listened to his speech. And as Cornell said correctly about Sanders, he missed his historical moment, which is that he should have walked out of the Democratic convention.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Bernie Sanders would have benefited if there were a third political party? And should there be a third political party?
Well, Sanders wasn't... I mean, Sanders told us that he didn't want to end up like Nader. And he's not wrong. If he had defied the Democratic machine, they would have pumped tremendous resources into Vermont to deny him his Senate seat. You know, that's how the ag industry got rid of McGovern. Hmm. People don't know that story, but McGovern ran a commission in the Senate after his presidential bid and exposed what especially the animal agriculture industry was doing in terms of Americans' health. And they quashed the report, and then they pumped tremendous sums of money to make sure he was defeated as the senator from South Dakota. So, yes, that's what they would have done. He would have lost certainly seniority. He would have, and the price he would have paid would have been steep. On the other hand, we've got to stop thinking around an election cycle.
Right.
Syriza 10 years ago was polling 4%. This is something that's going to take, because we're starting from scratch, it's going to take a long time to build, and we've got to, this is a marathon, it's not a sprint. And some of us may not even be around if it works, mm-hmm. but we've got to hold fast. Because if people see, even in defeat, that we hold fast to these moral imperatives no matter what, that is juxtaposed against two major political parties that don't really believe in anything. And I do respect Bernie, but he wouldn't take on imperialism. And that is that's the big issue, because we're never going to create a state where there's any kind of equality or equity until we destroy the war machine.
Now, there's a section of society that feels, regardless of who's in the White House right now or who was there for 8 years prior, that feel they have no representation and no protections. It didn't matter that we had a black president when you still had unarmed black boys and girls, men and women being murdered and abused by law enforcement. We saw a rise out of that in the form of the Black Lives Matter movement. Can you speak on that and the many who are just totally turned off by the political process right now?
Well, I see that as a hopeful phenomenon. I mean, when Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton went to Ferguson, they were booed.
Right.
And having met a few of the Ferguson activists, T. Dubbo and a few others, they get it. I mean, he was invited to the White House, and Obama asked him if he voted for him, and he said, "I vote for you because you've never done anything for black people." And I don't know how old he is. He's in his early 20s. Mm-hmm. So I find that consciousness quite heartening.
Does your analysis of corporate capitalism as the basic or central cancer of our society differ from that of Richard Wolff?
Yes. And I like Richard. I mean, he's a Marxist. And I'm a Presbyterian who read a lot of Calvin. So I have a pretty dark view of, and I years in war. So I'm not willing to see, you know, some people are altruistic. Clearly a lot of people are not. But I would break capitalism down in that I see corporate capitalism as an unmitigated evil and a force for death. But I grew up in a farm town, and so farmers would bring in their produce and sell their products, and it was a kind of penny capitalism. I don't see that as evil. I could even live under heavy regulation with a regional kind of capitalism, you know, somebody who owns a factory. Carl Pugliani in The Great Transformation kind of laid out what happens when capitalism runs amok. Capitalism is fundamentally an anti-democratic force, and it's a poison within your society. It's one, I think, that caters to human nature, but one that has to be heavily regulated and controlled. That's why you can't have monopolies. That's why, you know, public utilities, the fossil fuel industry, the banks, these all have to be nationalized. But that form of capitalism, you know, in a society where it's constrained, I can live. That would be probably a difference between me and Rick.
And Rick. Mm-hmm. Do you still think it's better? Wow. Do you still think it's better that Trump got elected instead of Hillary, as you told Robert Reich before the election? In terms of accelerating the political
development. No, I didn't say that to Robert Reich, and you can all go home on YouTube and watch it. I didn't say that it's better to elect Trump. This was a debate that I did with Robert Reich on Democracy Now. And Robert said, well, we'll build a third party after the election. And I said, it doesn't work like that. The failure among the left and the liberal class was that after the passage of NAFTA in 1994, the greatest betrayal of the working class in this country since the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act, we didn't turn on the Democratic Party. That's what we failed to do. And I covered politics, and it is a game of fear. There's that great, I've said it, some of you probably heard me say it, but there's that moment in Kissinger's memoirs, and no one's allowed to buy the book, where it's 1971, there's a gigantic anti-war demonstration, tens of thousands of people have surrounded the White House, Nixon has put empty city buses end-to-end around the White House, and he's looking out the window, wringing his hands, going, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. And that's exactly where we want people in power to be.
What are your concerns about the likelihood of Trump using the two recently enacted bills covering civil detention?
Well, the worst assault on our civil liberties up till now was carried out by Barack Obama. Both Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, and I sued Obama in federal court over this in the Southern District Court of New York. And surprisingly, we won, which kind of freaked out the NSA. I mean, it totally freaked out the NSA. And then on appeal, they didn't hear the case because it's such a patent violation of our constitutional right under the Posse Comitatus Act. So they just found all sorts of ways to deny my right to bring the case standing. So, I mean, Obama did. I mean, the tragedy is that they created all of these mechanisms and eviscerated so many of our rights, and it's now in the hands of a Trump. So this hardly began with Donald Trump.
Right.
In fact, there's not much left. I mean, wholesale surveillance. I mentioned in the talk all sorts of legal mechanisms like SAMS. I mean, it's almost the flick of a switch now.
Could you speak about the rise of veganism and the role it can play in the future of the earth?
Well, so my wife is a vegan and took me to see this film called Cowspiracy, which sounds like... It sounds like a Monty Python movie, but it's not. And I was kind of blown away by it because I spend my life writing about corporate power, and it was the piece of the puzzle that I'd missed in terms of the animal agriculture industry. And I really became a vegan because of what it does to the planet. The the stripping of the rainforest to grow soy, the vast wasting of resources, runoffs from pig farms, all this kind of stuff. And it was something you could get up in the morning and do. Mm-hmm. And I think we do have to do everything. Nothing is too small now. So, I can buy into the speciesism and all that kind of stuff. But for me, I really felt that this is a pretty evil industry. There's a reason they won't let us in these factory farms, because if we ever saw what we were eating, we wouldn't eat it. And it is better for your health. So,
switching gears, can you tell us about the students you work with and the play that you have coming up?
Oh, thanks.
Or the play that they're working on.
So I teach in a prison. And a couple years ago, I taught a drama course where we read August Wilson and Dutchman and Baldwin. And 28 students. And so at the first week, I, as an experiment, said, why don't you all write an autobiographical scene in drama form? And so I took home the 28 papers, which have that peculiar kind of musty smell that prisons have. And I'm reading through it, and I hit this one scene that's amazing. It turns out I had attracted three or four of the best writers in the prison. And that happened for a couple more weeks. And I was supposed to be writing my book, Wages of Rebellion. And I said, we might be able to put this together as a play. And so I added another day. You can only do it if students need remedial help. So I just wrote down that my entire class needed remedial help. And I dropped the book, and I spent 4 months cobbling together this play, which is their story. And I only have one student from that class who's out. Fortunately for me, he was my best writer, and he and I have been working on it. And as he said, it's like we were 28 men, but as we wrote, we realized we all had the same story. They're black. And poor. And what came out in these stories would just rip your heart out. I mean, for instance, I would say, okay, I need you to write a scene of you having a conversation with your mother. And after the class, one of my students said, well, what if we're a product of rape? And I said, well, that's what you have to write. So he writes this story, which is true. He's in Paterson, New Jersey, with his half-brother, who has a gun. The car is pulled over, the car is searched, they find the weapon. If nobody in the car takes ownership of the weapon, everyone is charged with a weapons violation. And Timmy says to the cop, it's mine. And he writes the phone call from the county jail, which is, it doesn't matter, Ma. I was never supposed to be here anyway, and you have the son you love. Mm. And they're all huge. I'm like a munchkin in there. And we had a reading of the play, and we couldn't perform it, and I invited Cornel West and James Cone to be our audience. And when Timmy read that part, he disappeared, and I said to my students, where is he? And I found him in the bathroom, huddled in the corner, just shaking and weeping. And that last day, they all signed the cover of the play. And we had read Joe Turner Come and Gone, great August Wilson play about black families going north, dealing with the trauma of slavery. And the conjurer, Byram Walker, keeps saying, you have to find your song. And I said, this is your song. And I don't know anything about producing plays, but I'm going to take it to every theater I can find. And this spring, the theater in Trenton will mount it if, starting on May 31st, I can get through Kickstarter $60,000 to put it up. So that's we get that, and Boris, the student who's out, is going to be in the play, and the rest will be professional actors. So It's called Caged. And there's a website. I'm so bad. I don't have a Facebook page or anything. But it's called Caged. And there's a website. And I'm not obviously not handling it. But the Kickstarter campaign starts on the 31st. And even if you don't have money to give, please send it around. That would be helpful.
And as these things go, there's always a lot to say and a lot of questions to ask, but never enough time. And we've run out of our time for this night. So on behalf of KPFA, I'd like to thank you all for coming out tonight. On behalf of Walden Books and independent bookstores, thank you for your consistent support. And thank you, Chris Hedges, for the work that you do, man.